Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain!
Not here.
Captain! Report. Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happened?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Those are Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
Ben, neither of us have been fired from this show yet. But in, I guess, what you could consider three bombshells of news dropped all at once, pretty big news out of the Star Trek Discovery camp this week.
Yeah, we had an episode recorded and ready to go, and we are still going to play that for the people. Is that right?
Yeah. That's going to come up after this.
But we felt weird like not addressing this because it came out after. We sent our wonderful guest, Manu Saadia, home, and I think like that afternoon this news broke. So we felt like we should hop in here and talk about it. Because we knew some of this going into this because we have back channels into the writer's room at Star Trek Discovery, the nature of which we cannot reveal.
Yeah, and I think it was smart to not break the news ourselves. I don't think we are that kind of show, and I don't think we're those kinds of people. But the news that we are talking about that we have not said is that Aaron Harberts and Gretchen Berg are out as showrunners at Disco.
Yeah,
and Alex Kurtzman is next in line.
He ascended to the throne. The thing that we had heard before this broke was that Akiva Goldsman had been shown the exit, at least from the writer's room, and I was very interested to hear to see the news because it kind of tacks the Akiva Goldsman news on as kind of like secondary. Also, this
right.
happened.
Yeah.
But, as far as we understood, that happened first.
Yeah.
And for very similar reasons where like there was kind of a hostile, uncool atmosphere and people were really not getting along in the writer's room.
This kind of news is surprising in some ways and unsurprising in a whole lot of others, in that the creative life and the creative career is a stressful life and a stressful career, and you hear about this more and more. Fortunately, this stuff is getting rooted out of productions and of shows and of movies.
The like people excusing behaving badly as being passionate.
Right. I think that's been a confusion that's been around for a century.
It is possible to make creative work and not be a dick about it.
Yeah.
I think that we have hesitated to like know quite how to comment on some of these things with Disco because I think we both feel a little bit like dicks having to say anything about it, right? Like we don't really know what's going on. We don't know everybody's mind, and this is all third-hand news that we're seeing, so
sure.
Maybe they are dicks, maybe they aren't, maybe, you know, it's just the kind of Game of Thrones that happens at any big, you know, high-profile media company where there's always angling and backstabbing and people rising and people falling. I mean, I think we've both experienced that
in our careers to one extent or another. And
I think what irritates me the most about, and this is not to say that anything that you've said is something I disagree with, but like the company line from this production from people like Berg and Harberts were that like this is creative work coming from a diverse group of people who care deeply about each other's well-being and about creating a great piece of Star Trek work that is reflective of the values of the people who create it. Like right. that has been a touchstone for the show from the start. And it is deeply irritating that's been the company line, and you read and hear stories like the ones that we're hearing from the writer's room. Like it's that kind of hypocrisy that makes it so hard to believe anyone when they say that they are operating from a position of the greater good.
Yeah, it's tough. I think that, you know, they made a good season of television. One of the things in the Hollywood Reporter piece that broke all of this news that has me a little bit anxious about season two is that a primary reason for their firing, aside from the fact that there was a lot of onset hostility and uncool vibes between them and their writing staff, they also burned a ton of budget in the first five episodes. And like CBS is not making the production whole. The first five episodes are shot, they're in the can, and the rest of the season is going to have budget taken away from it because of those overruns.
Yeah, I hope you're excited for a clip show.
It's a season two necessity.
Right.
That's a bummer to think about, right? Like the idea that we're going to get a fully or overfunded first five eps, and then they just have to do their best with the rest of what's left.
It's hard to predict what the consequence is going to be for the remainder of the season two episodes. I mean, you gotta feel great for the directors and producers behind the first five eps. Like, ooh, yeah. got away with those in the can.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Like the other thing to say is that we both went into season one with very low expectations. So perhaps this is a good thing, you know, for season two to have like level set our expectations as low because of these reports, you know?
Yeah.
But I guess maybe the silver lining is that it sounds like Kurtzman is like coming in midstream and they're going to keep producing the show on the schedule that they've been working on. And like, they're not going to delay it, at least from this. There's no sign that there'll be any delays yet. So keeping our fingers crossed that we get to go back into full swing on The Greatest Discovery pretty soon.
Yeah, I hope for the same. And I hope for everyone that's left involved in this production that it's smoother sailing from here. I don't think anyone enjoys making creative work while being yelled at for the effort. So hopefully this gets it fixed.
So I guess this was our Marin for Greatest Discovery, and the next thing you hear will be our hang with Manu Saadia of the great Star Trek popular economics book, Trekonomics. We had a really fun conversation with him, and I hope you guys enjoy it.
We have been waiting for someone worthy of our attention.
Who are you?
We've encountered them.
Those are Klingons?
We have a guest today, Adam. He has a name that I am always a little bit scared to pronounce. It's Manu Saadia.
Hey, there he is.
Manu wrote a great book that I really enjoyed called Trekonomics. It's kind of like a popular economics treatise on like how practical the idea of a post-scarcity future as depicted in Star Trek would be, and he hates Star Trek Discovery.
I do not hate. I am full of love for everything.
I thought it'd be interesting to have you on, because I think we've had a lot of people on that were big fans of the show, and you have some criticisms, right?
I do, but I would like to emphasize the positive first, which is I'm really happy that somebody decided to bring back the Narns on screen. And I thought, you know, since I really like Babylon 5 too, I thought this was nice.
You were saying something about Babylon 5 before we started recording that I found kind of baffling.
Well,
you said it was a precursor to Discovery? Are we to believe that these are taking place in the same universe?
Well, no. No, but the idea of, you know, a sort of soap opera in space,
yeah,
with weird aliens and the Narns, I think that's something. I'm rewatching Babylon 5 right now because they just put it on Amazon Prime.
Right.
And it's 20 years old and you know, it's clunky and like some of the production value is just not there. But the storytelling is pretty amazing. But I don't want to turn this show into the greatest Babylon 5.
The greatest Babylon 5 will never happen.
Yeah, I guarantee you that.
No, but like, you guys have to explain me why.
You're exciting about three people in our audience with all this Babylon 5 talk.
So it's like, die, Babylon 5, die! No, but like at least in terms of the form, which, you know, is non-episodic and a long story unfolding over however many episodes, Babylon 5 was very early on the sort of what is now standard for the golden age of TV.
Right.
They almost feel like Twin Peaks every once in a while, because Twin Peaks was really the first to do this. And you do have some actors from Twin Peaks who show up in Babylon 5, as well as Star Trek actors.
I like those choices.
I mean, you know, so I thought Babylon 5 was, had, and then if you remember.
The thing that about Babylon 5 that I can't get over, if I'm sorry for interrupting, but it's that it looks like cable science fiction in a way that is, that like Andromeda was, or.
No,
like,
Andromeda was worse.
I fully agree.
Although
and understand
Robert
that.
Although Hewitt Wolf, you know, great writer and.
There's a look to it that looks related in that way. There's like a gloss, like a cable TV gloss.
Yeah.
The way that like the Stargate television show also has this look to me. There's something that looks...
You mean the set redresses and the weird lighting? And
I think it might be a lighting thing. There's like a unified theory of science fiction lighting at work here on those shows.
And obviously, like, what kind of film stock they would use, and it probably was not the super premium.
They're totally like...
The broadsheet film stock.
They bought it out of a truck in a parking lot.
They went in to buy film, and the guy was like, well, I could get you some film, but I could also get you some film for 40% off if you meet me in my car after work.
It's been warming in my van for the last 8 hours.
No, I mean, it's true that the transfer to video like does not do a great service to it. But you could say the same for Next Generation, at least until...
The HD remaster made the Next Gen look really beautiful.
Yeah, that came out beautiful.
That show was lit differently for the first two seasons, though. Like, they had it figured out by the third.
I think The Expanse, which is a show I like a lot, and I think has just been acquired by Amazon, has the same, like, bad sci-fi cable lighting that you're talking about. Like, like, that is a tradition that is alive and strong today. And... Like, I was kind of wondering if Discovery was going to wind up looking like that, because it's like, I don't know, like, do you just, is no, that just, you know, what everybody does now?
No, they're making it in Canada.
And like, the Discovery looks a billion times better than The Expanse.
No, but also Discovery, I think, what I heard, like $10 to $12 million per episode.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's the number I've heard. So.
Yeah, but like at least $500,000 of that is just cocaine for the craft services table, right?
A lot of well-paid gaffers on that show.
Yeah, that's the, but the general idea of this sort of a continuous story that unfolds over, you know, several, Deep Space Nine adopted that format, sort of an echo to Babylon 5. There's a funny story about it that apparently Straczynski, so the creator of Babylon 5, had pitched a show on a space station to Paramount. And lo and behold, a year later, they do Deep Space Nine and they nearly killed Babylon 5. Which was also first friend syndication.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it was.
It would have been a mercy killing, right?
What are there, like 5 seasons of Babylon 5?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they had to shorten it. And then after the first season, they changed lead. So they get Bruce Boxleitner. I know.
The Bruce Boxleitner?
Welcome to The Greatest Bad Babylon, a podcast where we dunk on Babylon 5 for an hour.
No, but the larger point holds, though. The idea of doing a sort of operatic, novelistic type of science fiction show, really, Babylon 5 was the first to try. I was trying to think if there's anything else like that on TV before. I mean, maybe Twin Peaks, but Twin Peaks is not science fiction.
Yeah.
So, but you know, like the sort of big payoff, big stakes, melodrama, daddy issues, like the ferment of any kind of bingeable show is there in Babylon 5, and then you find it in Discovery, is why.
Yeah, when you're watching your Game of Thrones or your, I don't know, Better Call Saul, just know you're really watching Babylon 5.
You've got Bruce Boxleitner to thank.
I mean, he's such a great actor.
Was Babylon 5, like, it always lived on Sci-Fi Channel, right?
Was it Sci-Fi? No,
UPN when I was growing up.
Was it UPN or WGN or something?
Oh, I'm only familiar with it from, I guess, reruns on Sci-Fi then.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And then the last season was picked up by TNT, maybe?
Yeah, something I think
it has a troubled history.
It was one of those things where it was like, I think it started the way TNG did, where it was like not really on a network, but it was available for syndication.
First run syndication. That's what made TNG so unique.
Yeah.
Is because nobody except the producers had full creative control. So they could do whatever the hell they wanted. They proved that first run syndication for niche shows
was possible.
Yes. And that you could have a 7 season of socialism on TV without interference from the powers that be.
Right. If you just make a really good show about socialism.
Yes.
And you make Barney Boxmaker the face of your show. Good things are going to happen.
So in the case of Discovery, and that's where it's interesting as well, is Discovery is also trying to blaze a trail, sort of, for the franchise and using a new distribution medium.
Yeah.
So I was talking to friends who are in the industry and writers and all that, and they're like, it's a streaming show. So among some and, you know, more exalted people in the industry, writing for a streaming show is still not like the big prize is network.
It's like a low rent opportunity.
Yeah, like the big prize is the Orville.
And yet they're making like a big awards. Like, I mean, weird thing about living in LA is you see like the For Your Consideration everywhere. And Manu and I were having coffee a couple of weeks ago at like a normal coffee shop that normal people go to. And we were like, why are there Star Trek logos all over the place in here? And apparently there was just some like marketing push of For Your Consideration
by CBS
for Star Trek Discovery.
Like, wow. Yeah, on Sunset Boulevard.
Like your foam art was
it was the Vulcan salute.
Yeah.
I can make a pretty credible Saru's face in, in my foam.
And then you're going to die. Yeah.
So would you like to try our temporary threat ganglia breakfast sandwich?
Venti is a large coffee.
Really? Says who? Fellini?
Yeah, so Discovery is like that. I mean, Discovery, new medium, new thing. Everything's aligned. I know you guys love it, but I'm sort of... I'm like, eh.
Do you think it's just not your era? Like,
yeah, I mean, I'm old too, that's for sure.
I mean, but you grew up
I was
going
to say it, but I'm glad you did.
But you're like a TOS guy, right?
Are you kidding? No.
No, you're a TNG?
Completely.
But yeah. Because you told this story in your, yeah, in your mean, book.
I
mean, like,
but I saw the movies.
Being
which
exposed
is,
to the movies
my
first.
My first experience with Trek was the motion picture. Wow. I must have been 8.
That wasn't enough of a deterrent.
Oh, no, man. I was like, because it was like watching Cousteau. You know, I grew up in France.
Right.
And the biggest thing on TV in France when I was a kid, because we had like 3 TV channels and they were all public. Uh-huh. So it was like PBS 3 times. It was Cousteau. So
Jim Kirk really is the sexual Cousteau of science fiction.
Yeah. Although, you know, like in the motion picture, somehow they managed to actually rein him in. It like obviously he didn't realize how big he was.
Yeah.
He was just happy to be there. And they're all happy to be there, by the way. and then there's Spock.
He didn't have his Priceline money yet.
Mm. No. And, you know, he was not a cultural icon yet. I mean, he was T.J. Hooker.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like...
I got to start sliding over the hoods of police cruisers.
Well, yeah, with Heather Locklear.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was T.J. Hooker, man.
I've always wondered something about the motion pictures, how it played in foreign markets, because the whole, like, twist at the end is that the... No, alien man. Spaceship is...
We all grew up... I remember my class project that year was to do a model of the Voyager because it was the year one Voyager sent like, back the first
was
images
it dubbed?
From Jupiter.
Like, how do you do that joke in dubbed French?
Well, you don't. And that's okay because...
It just switched to subtitles at that point?
No, I was too young. But like it came across as a very serious movie.
Yeah.
And also kind of a trip. And then, you know, I rewatch it every once in a while. And then I'm like, oh my God, they managed to get Spock to say, I am penetrating the object. And it's a space vagina because it's and it just penetrates it. And
many of the same letters as a cross between vagina and Voyager.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know,
I'd be very bad at Wheel of Fortune, you guys.
But have you heard of the story also of Decker? So characters were supposed to be part of what was written for the second series of mm-hmm. Star Trek.
Yeah.
And then they changed Decker to Riker.
Yeah.
So that they wouldn't have to pay him residuals.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
And that guy apparently turned out to be a pedophile.
We need the money for the wood paneling on the bridge. We can't afford those royalties.
Yes. But Decker...
Yeah, Decker was a pedophile?
Yeah, Decker, like, he was... you know, that's why he never shows up at conventions.
Shit.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Boy, they really dodged a bullet there. Instead, they only had one pedophile on the show. Captain Picard.
Yeah, so that was my... So my exposure to Star Trek was really through the motion pictures. So the motion picture, The Wrath of Khan, which I understand you people are very fond of.
We're 21 tour dates fond of it.
Yeah,
it's an amazing movie.
I like to think that when they were coming up with the idea for Wrath of Khan, they were like, "I know we made the motion picture, but what if we pivot into something fun?"
Well, I mean, they kicked out Gene Roddenberry, so I mean,
yeah, the motion picture was so self-serious.
Yeah.
It felt like going to a lecture.
It was a trip.
Wrath of Khan is the result of like, hey, we have a lot of hamburger makeup to put on people.
Yeah.
You guys want to make a movie around that idea?
Has anyone ever fucked with ears in a major film?
Oh, yeah, that's true. I remember that scene. The first scene, like, it leaves an impression. But I must say, my favorite of them all, and the one that's the closest to TNG, in fact, is number 4, the whales.
Yeah, the whales is great.
The whales has no villain.
Ben and I had an argument about this just last night over Korean barbecue. I almost lost my appetite hearing how highly you slotted that film in your Star Trek movie hierarchy. It's like 2? Like,
oh, no, it's not 2. Is it?
I feel like you said...
What's your number one? Like
it's in the top 5 for me. But
what's your number 1?
6, Undiscovered Country.
I think 4 is as cheesy as First Contact. And I have both of those films fairly low.
I mean, you know, they're time traveled.
Adam is just angry at it because one time he was on a bus listening to loud punk rock and somebody Vulcan neck pinched him.
Luke, I just want...
You took that scene really personally, man.
I want an Orbison-less First Contact cut. Like, it's sort of related to a director's cut, but we're taking stuff away.
Yes. Like, make it tighter.
Yeah.
The producer's cut.
Right.
Star Trek fans believe that, and so do I.
Time travel episodes are, and time travel films are interesting because this is where you reveal the assumptions about the show.
Yeah.
So I thought The Whales is interesting in that. Because it's in the same sort of narrative box as Undiscovered Country. It's making fun of the Cold War and those silly humans and, you know, silly 20th century, silly San Francisco, double dumbass on you.
Yeah. We got to sell the glasses that Bones gave me to get some money.
Yeah. and transparent aluminum and...
Yeah.
Hello, and computer.
Computer. Computer. What I like about it is that it sort of articulates the utopian core of Star Trek much better than the other stuff, which is entertainment. And entertainment is great, and I'm happy to be entertained.
I'm happy to be entertained, too. That's why I don't consider watching Babylon 5.
Babylon 5 will make you work. Like, you will have to...
You know what? That's how my wife reviews our relationship. Like, are you happily married? Adam will make you work.
I mean, but it's like Discovery. You know, you have all these little Easter eggs and clues that are strewn, like, through all the episodes. And,
yeah, yeah.
And then you have to go back. And then when you rewatch it, you're like, oh, he said that. And
it rewards careful attention.
And it becomes this sort of interactive experience of rewatching and then podcasting about it. And then the podcast about the podcast and the what did it mean? Like, was he really a Klingon or not?
Yeah, yeah.
When, you know... It's this sort of a payoff narration.
This is your description of Discovery?
Yes, and Babylon 5.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I'm probably, one, I'm old, that's for sure. And also, I tend to believe that, I mean, I personally, what I like about Star Trek and why I love to watch Star Trek is precisely because in most of the episodes that I really like, nothing much happens.
Yeah.
And it's more, they're more like little... philosophical treaties.
Yeah.
You know, like Darmok. Like, there's nothing in... there's not nothing in Darmok, but it's like... It's
there's cheesy. An action jacket in Darmok.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, what did you guys do for the Darmok episode? Did you speak all in...
I think we made a very half-hearted attempt in the Darmok episode to do something, but I don't remember actually doing it.
Yeah. No, neither.
I don't know. Tweet us. Let us know what we did. It's impossible for us to remember.
It's all a blur. But you know, like, the kind of production that is required. I mean, it's not the same type of writing and production. Like, you lay out the whole thing, and you have arcs and characters, and it's all on the whiteboard and all that. When you do 24 episodes on network, it's more like, oh, we still have six to go, and
yeah, it's such a
we
long
don't have
runway.
Any money, and yeah. we need to do a bottle show, so...
Yeah, that's one thing that's actually a little bit of breaking news about Star Trek Discovery was... They're really going hard after some awards.
Yes.
And one of the episodes that they've put out front as award worthy is the Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad episode, the bottle episode with Harry yep. Mudd and the repetitive yes. timelines and stuff. And it was just revealed that that was a money-saving production choice and story choice. Like,
wow.
They went for the efficient... episode budget wise in order to get them to the finish line on the entire first
season.
But
they added episodes to this first season.
That's I also thought I remember hearing that, so
okay, I have a question. Like, what's with the long titles?
I don't know.
And the Latin? I mean, it's like whenever an episode is in Latin, I'm like...
They're very look-at-me titles. Yeah. Like I was an English major titles. It's
like, what was the one in Voyager that was like that? Like, enim ar, inter-arma enim silent ligat.
Yeah, we haven't like, gotten to like Voyager Cicero, yet, so we can't admit to ever having seen it.
Voyager's the same season that had an episode title called Year of Hell. Like,
oh, it wasn't Voyager. It was like Space Nine, I think.
I like my titles like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the pretentious title is something that you find a lot in Babylon 5 as well.
It's also in that tradition.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I'm saying, you know, it's like, oh, this is, you know, it's to flag. It's like, this is a very important episode, so we're going to call it Passing Through Getsemani. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a very good episode, and it's very well written, and it's like, but it's
there
sort
are very
of
a, few special effects that look like they were rendered on a PlayStation 1.
They were actually rendered on a Commodore 64 or an what? Amiga. No, like in Babylon 5.
No way.
And they were the first to do these renderings on
CG
computers.
CG ships?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because they didn't have money to do models. I mean, after 20 years, of course, we're sort of like, we're looking at this as if... But like, it's the same way we're looking at the original series. That stuff's really clunky.
Yeah.
And you know, like one step removed from Georges Méliès. It's so pretension seems to be one of the very important hallmarks of sci-fi in general.
Mm.
Like the sort of, you know, sci-fi.
I have smart ideas, and I'm going to tell them to you through
military this. Sci-fi. You know, it's all like, yeah, yeah, like, come on, guys. I don't think Next Generation ever did any episode with a title that was.
No, I mean, they didn't do that with their titles, but what they did do was the thing that is so fashionable in modern science fiction, which is like turn a contemporary problem into a science fiction problem.
Yeah.
And then like slowly turn to camera when the point is made about how to solve that thing.
You see, Wesley, drugs are very bad.
Right. Our warp engines are polluting this yes. galaxy, so I mean, we must slow down.
Let's also not forget that this is a series that has many episodes in which the captain quotes Shakespeare at length.
Hear this, Picard, and reflect.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he can do, yeah, but like he actually has the cred to do it.
He does. Like, he does like, it well, but it's also like, come on, guys.
Yeah, I mean, but I guess, you know, naming him Picard and then giving him a British accent and such a great thespian.
Yeah.
Well, did you just say
Babylon
that Captain
5,
Picard
Babylon
is pretentious?
5 could never get away with those choices.
Well, they had great actors.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about your book.
Barry Bixman is no Patrick Stewart. I'll tell you that much.
They had Stephen First from Animal House.
That's a great get.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your book because, like,
yeah, we need to be Ferengi a little bit.
So your book is kind of like what is actually like practicable about the economics depicted in Star Trek, right?
I mean, I was trying to like take it seriously as an object of economic theorizing, or, you know, like, okay, so we have 600 hours of TV and they seem to be very consistent regarding the way things work,
right, like
in the background.
How the society that these people come from.
Yeah, because one of the pleasures of any sci-fi, by the way, is to sort of imagine what's not on screen.
Right.
It's like, okay, so these guys are on screen, but like what's like who's making the food? What do you do for entertainment? You know, like you go to Ryza.
We had a conversation last night about like what is in it for the people that like work as waiters in 10 Forward? And the only thing we could come up with is, like, Riker is in there available for sex a lot of the time.
Yeah, they also participate in the poker game.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, I mean, Lower Decks is one of my all-time favorite episodes.
Yeah, mine too.
It is that episode where you see the underlings.
Is your understanding that that stuff is all, like, pretty much in place by the time of Discovery? Or is like...
No,
TOS is like still.
There is this epistemological break between the 23rd and the 24th century, and you know they don't have replicators in the original series. They have barely functioning computers. If you remember the movies, they have like a galley kitchen,
yeah,
where they make gah, so
and mashed potatoes.
Yeah, yes, that famous scene. So
if Adam and I could just have a podcast about the scene where she suits the mashed potato pot, I think we would.
Yeah.
it's a very distinctive scene. And she's,
we've talked about how much we both want that prop so bad.
It would be the best, the ultimate.
I would clear everything out of this room and just put it on a pillar in the middle. Like,
yeah. I'd put it under a glass dome.
But do you think it's poured vinyl or poured latex or something? Because it really looks good.
It's totally like commercial food magic.
Yeah. Well, Star Trek IV is probably the one where they talk the most about it, right? Until First Contact, where Kirk says, like, we don't have money, I'm not used to any of this stuff.
No, even in number four, like the whales episode where they need to find money.
That's
like,
what I just said.
Yes. But it seems
Are you even listening, or are you trying to pivot us back into Babylon 5?
Like, it's been a long...
Don't manipulate this show, man.
So that's the moment of the break, I guess. Here's the thing that I find annoying about the original series is they have credits.
Right.
You know, like, that's their currency. They have credits. Like, in the Tribbles episode, like, they're going on shore leave and they're buying and selling
but
stuff
with
credits.
But couldn't that be the same thing as Latinum in Deep Space Nine, where it's like, this space station isn't...
No, but they call it credits, man.
Yeah.
It's like every other science fiction show. In Star Wars, it's Empire credits.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Resistance credits or whatever. Like, everybody uses credits. It's such a...
I have a friend who wrote a science fiction novel, and he like sent it to me to read before he like sent it to publishers. And I think he was just like, yeah, you can read my novel. But what I presumed was that he wanted lots of notes.
and he had credits.
I sent them to him. Yeah, he had credits. Yeah, and that was one of my notes, was like, let's like, come up with something better than credits.
Cut to the end of this story. You're not still friends.
Yeah. He sent back an email just like, wow, this is not really what I expected from this interaction.
I didn't think I had allowed markup in the PDF I sent you.
No, but it's an important point, because it means that nobody actually cares about the meaning of money and currency. Every currency out there has a name because it has a history and it's embedded in it. I mean, the dollar comes from Joachim Stahler in Germany, which were like silver mines. And it comes from the Thaler, which was the money of the Austro... Charles Quint, Charles V, the Habsburgs and all that stuff. And it comes from the Hispanicization of Thaler.
Huh.
So Tolar and then Dolar and then Dolares. And so every currency that is being used has a history and is embedded in the culture. The shekel in Israel is, you know, the shekel from the Bible, or the drachma in Greece before the euro. The credit thing as this sort of...
Well, and the euro, like, had a tough time getting off the... And it just feels like fake money.
Yes.
Initially.
And like, it feels like a credit, really.
Yeah.
In the same way. So there's this thing about not paying attention to these details that then was corrected later on, especially in TNG. Although, you know, it starts with Farpoint and they're buying tchotchkes. But then, you know, the latinum and all that. And... I think there's a real difference, and the main difference is the replicator. Right. And when you look at, I mean, you are scholars of the next generation.
Is your book primarily about how the replicator changed
because the interesting part is the Ferengis also use replicators, mm-hmm. but they make you pay for it.
Right.
So, and they make a killing, and it's a great way to prevent bartenders from unionizing,
yeah,
because you can keep wages very low that way. So this is a lesson to learn for the present, I guess. The decision to make the replicator into a public good, so something that anybody can use, is essentially a political decision. That's the only way you can interpret the social place of the replicator and stuff.
Yeah. Like, one of the first times I can recall the replicator being used in that way was, like, season 7 of TNG when like, they have Rolaren set one up, or they have Worf set one up on that planet that they visit with Rolaren. Like, it seems like they could be sprinkling these things around more than they are.
Replicators, yes. Yeah. For the Bajoran resistance,
yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
Yes. The replicator, when you...
they let Sonny Clemons replicate that $5 carnival guitar.
So. Right.
Well, it's the neutral zone.
Computer, can you make it stupider looking?
The replicator also, like, except for very few episodes, there's the one where the micro comps or the exo comps or whatever, the little machines that self-replicate.
Yeah.
The replicator otherwise is like pure signifier, because it's just the coffee machine in Picard's ready room, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they could have, it's not that they wanted to save money on extras, like, you know, the guys who will bring the tea or anything. They made a point of having replicators. So showing that anything you want is available by voice command and will be produced, right away. It's like Amazon Prime, but better. And that you don't see, like, they make a point of Picard sitting down and, you know, computer, what is it, computer? No, it's like tea, Earl Grey, hot.
Right.
If the replicators work like Amazon Prime, that tea would come in a box like four times too large with like just a shitload of packing material around it.
Like, I ordered a replacement filter for our air conditioner and it came in like almost a refrigerator box. And like a ton of packaging, and
there's an algorithm behind it, I guess.
I strongly believe, like, if Amazon wanted to, they could pivot into the world's biggest recycling program, like, and they could do a world of good by having curbside packaging material pickup for all of your Prime items. Like, if they just came a day later to grab all that stuff,
right?
But then it would be stored in some hangar in LA because China is not accepting cardboard boxes anymore.
Whoa. Wow.
Maybe Amazon will change the way they package stuff. But yes, it's essential. I think, except for the part where you pay, the idea of, you know, this sort of jukebox in the sky that can produce anything, that's very different from the original series. And I think it's a political decision, but it's also something that has tremendous impacts on the motivations and the way these people think, and Roddenberry very early on, like in the Bible of the show, actually laid out what it means. And these are people who grew up in a world of plenty and who have right. no...
They're not stressed out by
they're not
commercial or economic issues.
There's a person behind the food slot on Discovery making those breakfast burritos with the sun-dried yeah. tomato salsa
yeah.
for keep, the lycopene, right?
They keep several gimps on board yeah. to live in the walls and slide food to the...
But that's also, okay, that's the part of Discovery that annoys me to no end. It's the fan service. Because if you remember, in the original series, they have these slots
yeah.
where food is mm-hmm. being... So that's what they're doing. They're doing the fan service of updating and upgrading and...
The fans are never satisfied either way, so I don't know why they feel so married to that stuff. You know?
Yeah.
It's like a hostage negotiation, though. Like, where do you draw the line on serving them before you don't become the creator of the story you want to tell?
Although, interestingly enough, contrary to Star Wars, where, fans will go on rampage about women actors, like, there's very little of that for Discovery, just because Star Trek is not as...
Yeah. I mean, we've seen a little of it, but...
But it wasn't...
Yeah.
I mean, there were some people like bemoaning SJWs and all that, but yeah. it never reached the...
I mean, we've seen people like say that they hate The Greatest Generation because we're a couple of liberal cucks, and it's like, did you watch the show we're reviewing? It's a fucking communist space opera.
Yes. Yeah, somehow, I mean, it's... But that's why, you know, Ted Cruz is a fan of Captain Kirk.
Right. He loves those credits. Yum, yes. Nom, 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 nom.
Give and also credits. Kirk fucks.
Do you think Ted Cruz? Nah.
No.
Nah.
No.
No. Oh. Well, I mean, it's one of these things like, is it Shatner versus Cruz in a sexually compromising situation? I don't know if I can pick any of them. I mean, it's... Although, again, the original series is fantastic. You remember that episode? Like, what is it called? Where Little Girls Are Not, or What Little Girls Do, or something. Like, it has this very creepy title.
Yikes.
And it's the episode where Kirk is seen chasing an alien with a giant dildo in his hand.
I've only seen pictures of that episode. I've never actually watched it.
And the bad alien... speaks in a woman voice. Like, it's all gender bending in all the bad ways.
Right, yeah.
You know, 60s.
I've only seen one episode of the original series, and that was Space Seed. That's yeah. it.
Adam actually did research for Greatest Gen Con.
Yeah.
So, Adam, you're not a TOS fiend?
Here's my position on that. I was not a fan of the original series, and didn't think I would be. But then I watched Space Seed, and I actually... It opened me up to the idea of watching more of it.
Didn't we watch one for Disco? We watched the...
Because it's really...
Oh, we watched the Mirror episode.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Mirror, because it's tied to Disco.
And both of those episodes I thought were really good, but we were also told those are some of the best episodes there are.
Yeah. And they're not, like, great. They're just like, oh, this is better than I expected.
I would much rather be impressed by something that I go in thinking I'll hate than disappointed by... Okay.
So
that's what happened to us when we went to see Solo.
Yes.
Me and Manu saw Solo together.
Yeah.
We went in just bracing ourselves for a turkey, and we both
pretty good, really liked it.
But
there was no force and bullshit, so it was straight up... Yeah, it's an interesting comparison between this and Discovery in a way. Like, Discovery is fanfic, so is Solo. So, and Solo is the kind of fanfic where I can get on board with, because it actually delves into, you know, some of the problems in Star Wars itself. Like, say, you know, it's full of fucking slaves in Star Wars. Like, there are slaves everywhere. And
Star Wars has traditionally had a slavery is okay policy.
Yeah, I mean, it's very disturbing, right? This is a Disney franchise.
Yeah,
it's very not free to be you and me.
So it delves into that, and it tries to sort of make it a more of a problem. Discovery is also fanfic about the original series, it seems to be...
You used the term fanfic a couple of times, and I want to probe that a little bit, because I think the way I'm interpreting that description is that because it is not written by the original source material creators, is that the definition that we're using when we use that term?
Yeah.
Or are you using it as like a dunk because it's not something that you like?
No, because I've, believe it or not, I read a lot of fanfic, and I think, you know, fans are incredibly creative, and there's something beautiful about this selfless production of stories that are just made for friends to be read, and it's basically to impress other people.
Yeah, and there's something really compelling about seeing Sonic the Hedgehog pregnant.
If by do you mean like engorging?
I mean, and you know, like one of the subgenres of fanfic was slashfic, and the Kirk Spock thing, which it started very early on.
Yeah,
and in fact, brought to light something that was implied in the show, and one of the reasons people really took to the show is because it was essentially very queer before the word existed or was fashionable. But so it's one of these things where the fans actually help generate additional insight and culture around the original material. And I believe that the Solo movie, for instance, really took to heart some of the questions that have been raised in the fan community about slaves and slavery in Star Wars. At least try. So Discovery does that too. And you know, like, do Vulcans have emotions? And it seems to be probing that sort of, why are the Klingons so crazy? And it takes these little issues and make them into standalone story drivers.
Yeah.
And in that respect, it is fanfic. To me, at least, but it's fanfic that it's almost like as if the fans have won, and now, you know, they have certified fans who are also professional writers who write for the show. it's their take on it is really, it's one take among many. That's the thing, and it turns out to be the one that's sanctioned by Paramount.
Right,
but. Their take being that...
We have found that our take is not sanctioned by Paramount.
Or recognized.
and you might not... And actually, you know, given what they did with Discovery, you might not want to be recognized by Paramount.
Yeah, I don't know if we're emotionally equal to the kind of hatred we would get.
No, but also, you know, the movie... the Star Trek fan movies, like, this is a big thing in the Star Trek community.
Yeah.
Much more so than in the Star Wars community, where, you know, they do YouTube videos with like lightsabers, but that's about it.
Right.
This is like a part of a larger conversation about what I feel like is wrong with culture right now, which is like the presupposition that like the creator of a thing is deserving of your opinion, whatever it is. and like those loud, angry opinions form such a cacophony of bad feelings about things that many, many people like. Like I realize I'm coming off as a hypocrite about this because Ben and I make a show that criticizes something that we love, while at the same time, on occasion, mentioning the ways in which we would do it better. And those are like things that are irritating for me to read about things like the newer Star Wars films or about Star Trek Discovery. But like, I don't feel like the creators of these things owe them anything, and they don't owe me and Ben anything.
Right.
And I really... It's so fucked up how it appears to be having an effect.
I have some friends who wrote on Star Trek previous iterations of the show and their general view. And, you know, and they're professional writers, not dilettantes like me. And their view of the fans is like, fuck them. But they're only writers, you know, so they don't have to, they don't take the brunt of, right. of the adoration or criticism the right. actors do.
Right. Which is crazy because the actors are just there to interpret the words. Like,
well, it's the upside down world of entertainment, right? Yeah. It's the people who actually do the very important work. You never mm-hmm. see them.
Mm-hmm.
The actors, you know, like they're I'm sorry, actors are expendable and interchangeable, and they get old.
Like something about like the promos for Disco show so much behind the scenes stuff, and I wonder if there's like an attempt to diffuse mm-hmm. some of that like vitriol, like
by humanizing it in a like neighborhood theater yeah, type of way,
right? Like, I mean. That kind of attributes strategy to something that it's, I'm not sure. Is
yeah, but on
strategy.
The other hand, I mean, you remember like the opening credits of Discovery has like more executive producers than actors. So, you know, I mean, this tells you,
like I said, $500,000 for cocaine on the craft services table.
Yeah.
Like that tells you everything you need to know about what a mess it is. It's a it's official fanfic, but that's my take on it. It's with the sort of when you read some fanfic that is not very good, it has all these things where it wants to look and feel exactly like the original stuff. So it has to put all these references and cues, and whether visual or in language, and it's another question about this, and which, you know, goes to the fanfic issue. Why didn't they go for 200 in the future? 200 yeah. years in the future? Like, why not? What was, you can do it, you get 10 million per episode, you can do anything you want. And they have to do, no, they have to do Spock's secret sister. Like, come on.
It's because it's nostalgia is a shortcut to popularity, I think.
Like, I wonder why they haven't talked about Spock's megalomaniac brother at all.
I know.
Right?
Give me some of that Cybok.
Yeah, I need Cybok. Yeah, where is Cybok? I'm sure he's coming in the second season. I mean, like, if...
I would love that.
Yeah, real, like, fan service of celebrating Star Trek V.
But, dude...
A film I like more than Star Trek IV.
I really like...
You're
I really
a moron.
I like Star Trek V.
I'm stopping this podcast immediately. I just found out my co-host like Star Trek V more than Star Trek IV.
There's one great scene in Star Trek V. It's the opening where Captain Kirk
is climbing El Capitan. Great is not necessarily a word I would use to describe that scene. Like, maybe in the context of great big piece of shit, but...
God damn irresponsible.
Yeah, I mean, the mention of Cybok brings back all these memories. But like, okay, so why is it that the Vulcans, except for Spock and his father, are all like nuts? Because you need a villain, right? Or they're sort of tangled.
Vulcan extremists that's an idea that was explored in TNG too. Like people
and in Enterprise.
Yeah.
Like the fundamentalist Vulcan.
Is Enterprise canon? That was a joke. I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
Look for my book coming out next year.
Oh, also, Manu, can you introduce us to, like, I don't know, some kind of book publisher?
Someone who could teach me how to write a book?
Yeah, I'm not happy about Discovery, but it's just because I'm generally not happy about science fiction, and I'm generally not happy
about...
That
seems to be a big part of being a person who enjoys science fiction, is having a lot to dislike about it, you know? It's sort of like being a fan of a sports team that is right. unsuccessful. Like, it's sort of an identity, right?
My wife doesn't dislike science fiction. She's just totally indifferent to it.
Right.
And that seems like a really healthy way to be.
Yeah.
No, I wish I were indifferent to it. Doing the book, writing the book, and then I had to rewatch all this stuff. And then I realized it's not science fiction that I really like. It's socialism.
Guys, support for the show comes at MaximumFun.org/donates.
Yeah, redistribute your wealth to us. And
yeah, but okay, I say socialism because it makes for a good joke. Although it's not entirely a joke, like the utopian, the possibilities of what we could be if we were better organized.
Well, like,
but why do the unionized starships run so poorly?
The Enterprise never gets into port on time. But like the idea that like you could get to a point where making consumer goods is so insanely cheap that it is essentially free,
but it already is.
But we still, you know, everything is still super expensive. And
I think Paul Krugman had the perfect comeback to that, and his view is that human needs are always new needs produced, and that's why we're always unhappy. Because once you sort of like get past making food for cheap or clothing for cheap or watches for cheap or whatever, you will always find something else to make you unhappy about and wanting to signal to your neighbors. And
that's a great point, and it's going to save me a fortune in therapy because I'm never going to get over this.
Okay, so you guys are going to make fun of me, which is par for the course, but
we would never.
I feel that, you know, in my life, in the past 10 years, I've been trying to slowly shed this thing and become a very simple person in my tastes and in the things I do and in the things I consume. Well, it's also, I have a kid, so if you buy expensive clothes, they're just gonna
get barfed down.
Yeah, exactly. So that sort of went away. And you know, you live in LA, so it's just gonna be shorts and t-shirts. And but I've been trying to sort of live the life of making things becoming simpler and simpler, and trying to concentrate on worthwhile cultural pursuits instead of, you know, buying a new car every year. And it's hard. Because it's just you're
culturally going, we have a lot ingrained in us about like what we should be doing.
Yeah. You're going against the grain.
One person's worthwhile cultural pursuit is another person's Babylon 5, though.
My people were biologically determined for one purpose alone: to sense the coming of death.
What?
To sense the coming of death.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
This doesn't make any sense.
I sense it coming.
Any sense. Sounds like nonsense to me.
Adam, no P1s for today's episode, but if folks want to get a Priority One message, all they have to do is go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message. And you can
But if you have a book about Star Trek, you can just come on the show.
Yeah, indeed. So those are a great way to support the show. Speaking of your book, Manu,
let me be a Ferengi for a minute.
I read your book. I was recounting to Adam that I read your book because our show had come out, and you just tweeted me like, "Hey, you might like my book about Star Trek," which the odds of that turning out well in my favor are pretty long, but I like went and bought the book and I read it and I really enjoyed it. So I recommend it to anybody that's like interested in the practicalities of what's depicted in Star Trek.
A big part of a book plug is saying the title. That title is Trekonomics, The Economics of Star Trek.
Yes, by Manu Saadia.
By Manu Saadia.
And it's available on Amazon and iBooks and
everywhere.
Do you read the audiobook version of it?
Yes, it's the guy who did the audiobook version, originally they were trying to get Will Wheaton to do it.
Oh.
But the feedback was that he was not really engaged with the material. That's a true story.
Was that a pull quote that you put on the book? Like, I'm not very engaged with this material.
Yeah, Will Wheaton. Too busy playing tabletop board games to get engaged with the material.
No, but I think in a way it was kind of perfect that Wesley wouldn't be into this. Yeah.
Well, he's too busy like to warp with his mind or whatever.
It would have moved so many copies.
Yeah.
But it turned out the guy who did the audiobook in the end is this incredible voice actor called Oliver Wyman. And he does impersonations of Picard and me. And,
cool.
Yeah, so it's really funny. It's a great listen.
That almost sounds like worth getting, even though I've already read the book.
That's Trekonomics, The Economics of Star Trek. It's my first and last book about Star Trek. I will not write about Star Trek anymore after
that. Are people, like in the way that we've described earlier in the show, like do people give you their opinion of it in a way that is annoying?
I was told I was a Chi-Com and, various types of insults from very angry, crazy uncles on the internet. And then, you know, the usual socialist squad on Twitter was always down with
it. Well, you got to break out your mute hammer and sickle on those folks.
And everybody with a rose in their username on Twitter was like, great book.
Yeah, but like the other thing is, in the end, it turns out like after, you know, the whole book and looking into this seriously and taking it seriously, it turns out Star Trek is pretty much Keynesian, you know, social democrat. It's not even really socialism in the way people depict it as, you know, 1984.
It's not like a planned economy. It's like...
No. Yeah. The planned economy in Star... I mean... No, let's stop. But like, I was going to talk about the Borg. But
speaking of cultures that really get it right,
yeah.
Well, it is the other post-scarcity society.
That's true. Well, thanks so much, Manu, for
coming
on the show.
Thank you guys for having me on.
And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode of The Greatest Discovery. What do we do? We let Rob take it from here?
I think we have to.
Okay.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Benjamin R. Harrison, and it's produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusea. Head on over to MaximumFun.org/donate to help with the ongoing production of our show, or leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is at CutForTime, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. Make sure to use the hashtag GreatestGen or GreatestDiscovery when talking about the show. We'll see you next week.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.